This week on the Barrag World Show, we have talks about the many layers of design and the product design playbook. This week's show is sponsored by FreshBooks and Full Story. Hello and welcome to the Barrag World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul Barrag, and joining me on this show is Marcus Lillington.
My full name? Well, it's not my full name. I have...
What's your middle name? Go on.
I have two middle names.
Ooh, show off. Yeah, that's almost as bad as a double barrel name, isn't it?
Yeah, but they're really boring. They're Brian, after my dad, and John, after one of my granddads. So it's like...
There you go.
Yeah, it's like... Yeah. Marcus Brian John Lillington.
Yeah, as a whole it sounds okay, but individually.
And you, Paul?
My middle name is Alexander.
Oh, see, that's quite posh.
Well, my great-great-granddad was Alexander, Alexander Boag, and then my granddad was Robert Alexander Boag, my dad was David Alexander Boag, I'm Paul Alexander Boag, and my son is James Alexander Boag.
Not very creative there.
No, we're not an imaginative family when it comes to names.
I quite like the fact that your great-great-granddad was Alexander, which makes him Alexander the Great.
Yeah, see what you did there? That's good. I like that. I don't know what was so great about him that we feel a need to name four generations after him. He must have been amazing.
Yeah, the one thing I thought you would know is that...
No idea. Don't know anything about him at all.
Well, but my mum always says to me, she always says that I'm like her dad. He died, I don't know, 10, 15 years before I was born.
Right.
And I always say, so what was he like then? And nobody says anything. It's like, come on, tell me. And they change the subject.
So he must have been pretty bad then, mustn't he?
I don't know. I'm probably adding to the, I'm making it sound worse than it actually was, I suspect. But yeah, I really don't know anything about him. I think I looked like him. I think that's all it was.
There you go. So thank you for moving the podcast back a day.
That's okay, Paul. You've been away, haven't you?
I had to go to where did I go? I can't even remember. Freiburg, in Germany.
Oh, what, Smashing Magazine?
Yeah, yeah.
Headquarters.
I had a day with them. I've taken on. It's very exciting, actually. This is the first place I'm announcing it.
Ooh.
That I've become a director. Well, they don't. It's a little bit different in the way it works in Germany. But basically, I'm a director of Smashing, which is very cool.
Do they have kind of boards and things like that?
Yeah, they do. They have different types of... They have two levels of board, and okay. I'm on one of the levels. I don't really understand it. And also, they have a lot... As is very German, they have a lot of kind of protocol about how you do things. And one part of that protocol is that you have to read out a load of stuff at the beginning of the meeting, and it has to be read out in German. So I have no idea what I've agreed to.
And you agreed to it? Yes, yeah. Fine. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. No, they did. they did explain it to me.
That is exciting, Paul.
It is very exciting. They've got some really good stuff coming up as well. So we're going to be launching a membership service, which is very, very cool. We're very close to launching the redesign of the site as well, which is also exciting. And I'm doing more and more stuff for them, so I'm writing a lot for them as well. I've got quite a lot of, one article's just gone out, and I'm writing for them regularly now, really. And then I'm also going to Barcelona, as are you.
I'm going to Barcelona as well, and I am... I've been booking flights and hotels just these last few days.
Glad you have. I ought to do that, wouldn't I, really?
Well, yeah, of course I got it wrong, though, because Chris has to leave because he's got to be back for his wife's doing some... She's speaking at a conference on the Thursday, so he has to leave on the Wednesday evening, and I'd booked him a hotel room for the Wednesday. Mind you, because I've made my life complicated, in a good way, in the fact that I have decided that following the conference, I'm going to drive from Barcelona down to sort of nearly Almeria. And stay at a friend's villa down there that we stayed in earlier this year and have a long weekend. So it's quite scary, and I'll have Caroline with me also, who is not a good passenger. I've got to pick up a hire car from Barcelona train station and then drive about 700 miles.
Ooh, dear.
But it's an adventure.
Yeah,
no.
It's good for you.
I want to stop at Valencia, because I've never been to Valencia, and on Valencia's sort of about, it's nearly halfway, it's a bit nearer Barcelona than where we're going. So I thought, well, let's stop there and go and have a look about and then carry on the adventure. So yeah, but I'm already a little bit worried about it.
Oh dear. Oh well, have fun.
Yeah, so if we don't come back, you'll know we got lost on a motorway in Spain somewhere.
You can't get lost these days. It's pretty much impossible, isn't it?
Well, that's true. Yes.
Also, especially now, with for one wonderful moment in time yesterday, going to Freiburg, I could use all my mobile data and my phone call just like in the UK because of the EU legislation. Cool, it won't happen for long, will it? Because we're leaving the EU.
Well, that's true, Paul. Maybe we should ring up Andy Clark and get his opinion on that.
No, let's not. He doesn't care now. He's gone native.
Exactly, yes. Who cares about Europe, I suspect, would be his response. But my phone provider does a thing where I think you pay £3 a day when you're in Europe, and it's the same as being at home for your extra £3 a day, which I'm fine with.
So you don't have to pay your £3 anymore.
Don't you?
No. Wherever you are in Europe, they have to respect you. It's just like using at home now.
I think I'm being charged for that.
Well, you should. It's only as from the beginning of June. So unless you've been over to Europe since the beginning of June, you will have been charged. But when you go over in October, you won't be.
I was in Spain in June. Ooh. And I don't know if I got charged out there or not.
I can't remember the exact date, so it might have been mid-June or end of June, but it was somewhere in June.
Yeah. Okay.
So, very cool.
Thanks,
then
Paul.
We'll lose it. Thanks. Thanks. Thanks all those Exeter's people. Other than that, I don't care. But, I like my data.
Well, yeah, and not having to kind of queue up for hours at airports.
And
decent, decent exchange rates and things like that would be nice.
Well, you see, Brexit, I'm very much a Remainer, but Brexit has worked in my favour so far. Because I get paid a lot in other non-sterling value money. So, of course, the exchange, because the pound's really weak, my payments have been higher.
The same has applied for us with our American clients. That's true.
So it's good, isn't it? So there we go. Yay! Brexit's great.
Brexit.
Yeah.
Not.
No. So, yeah, I'm very excited about being involved with Smashing Magazine, because they're they're famous and important and shit.
Famous.
That's
all you've ever wanted, Paul, isn't it?
Yeah, I am just such a just so desperate for the limelight. I am worried that they're going to work out that,
you're a fake.
Yeah.
There's imposter syndrome striking again.
Shh, don't tell them. Don't tell them I don't know anything. I was giving them all this advice yesterday and my opinion on stuff and sitting there and thinking, they're listening. How dumb are they? But there you go. No, we need to get Vitaly on the show.
Yeah, definitely. Well, he's been on before, I'm sure.
I don't think he has.
Years ago.
Maybe. It was so funny sitting there, mind thinking, you guys are all having to do your board meeting in English because of me. Ha!
Yeah, that's a bit poor, really, isn't it? But not that I expect you to understand fluent German, but it's not great.
It was embarrassing. It was embarrassing. And when I mentioned the fact, they're just so blasé about it. Oh, it's not a problem. Of course we can just switch between any one of 20 different languages you fancy. Let's do the next bit in Japanese.
Yeah, Cornish.
Cornish.
That'd be good, though, wouldn't it?
That'd be awesome.
Do you reckon they could do the accent? We'll have to ask Vitaly, however you pronounce his name, when he comes on the show. On that subject, Paul, I'm going to put you on the spot now.
Okay.
And say, so next season then?
Yeah.
What we're going to do?
Ah, see, now that's really funny because at the bottom of my notes, I've got talk about next season.
Ah, okay.
So so do you want me to do it now or shall I save it for
the
end?
Well, seeing as I've asked you about it, you probably should respond now.
See, you're not very good at this whole kind of marketing thing. You know, like presenting, you're supposed to say later in the show, you know, and it kind of keeps people listening. If I say now, they're all going to just go, well, there we go, I'm done now. Because they obviously, you know, listen for that piece of information, not the really good talks we've got coming up. No, what we're going to do, we've never done a season on content.
Okay.
So we're going to look at content and in particular, probably it's going to be looking a little bit more specifically, I don't know, at like content marketing side of stuff. Well, we're going to get into a bit of everything. We're going to do a show on podcasting. We've never done a show on podcasting. So we're going to do that. We're going to do blogging, SEO,
okay.
Video.
Yep.
The use of video, use of imagery in your content, social media, headlines, writing processes, tone of voice, email marketing, and having an editorial calendar.
Okay, I've got loads to say on all that. I'm glad you didn't do it on coding or something.
Well, yeah.
That's never going to happen, is it?
It's never going to happen. Not with us two presenting. People are listening to the wrong show if they want that in-depth code advice. Was it Shop Talk? The CSS tricks people do? They must talk about coding.
Yeah,
and so. Who else? Jen Simmons in hers. What's hers called? I can't remember. Web Ahead? They must do as well.
Yeah.
But it's quite hard, to be honest, to talk about development on a podcast because, like, there's no pictures. You can't show anything.
Yeah, true.
So there's only so much you can do. Mm. Right, should we kick things off, he says, 12 minutes in.
Yes. Who's up first, Paul?
Well, no, we've got to do a sponsor first. Oh, it's not that easy.
Oh, it's really complicated, this podcasting lot. We need to do a show on it next series.
Yeah, or we need to be better organised ourselves. Like, if I'd sent you through the notes, you would know that a sponsor is next.
This is true. You stopped doing that about 5 episodes ago.
I got bored.
Yeah, well.
Because I was pretty sure you didn't read them anyway. The honest truth is, it's because you're now more organised than I am. I didn't put this together until yesterday evening. You'd already listened to the shows, to the talks by then, hadn't you?
Yes, I had, but it's going to bite me today.
Because you won't be able to remember them.
Because I did it on Friday, which feels like years ago.
Exactly.
And I've read my notes and I've gone, don't know what that means.
Absolutely. So anyway, full story. Because I've got to keep people up with this ongoing saga that I'm having.
What, with your intro text?
With my intro text. Right, because obviously people want to know how the story's going to turn out. It's like Game of Thrones, but
it's just like Game of Thrones. Although I tried to watch Game of Thrones on what series is it on now?
Oh, well, 28, six, maybe. Yeah,
I tried because obviously I didn't watch it, and there was sort of a hoo ha. Sort of happening about it. I think it's sort of series 4, and I thought, you know what, I'm gonna try. I'm gonna go for it. And I watched. Somebody did a program. A famous person, I can't remember who it was, about what had happened in the first 3 series.
No, you got to watch it from the beginning.
Anyway, I didn't. So I watched the first 2 episodes of series 4 and thought, yeah. I was like,
You're not invested in the characters by that. You know, if you just jump in partway through, yeah, you know the synopsis, but you know. You don't hate Ramsay or
anyway,
you know,
I gave up.
Love Sansa or whatever. Yeah, well, fair enough. It's not everything is for everybody.
True.
But the last episode, episode 4 I've just watched, was amazing. Was incredible. What was really impressive about it is it was, you know, it made Lord of the Rings look crappy. in terms, you know, and this is a TV show, in terms of visual quality.
Wow.
Just incredible, incredible, you know, explosions and CGI, and it really was quite outstanding for a TV show. Never seen anything like it on TV.
They do make a lot of money, so I guess that's why they can do it.
Anyway.
Yes, moving on.
My intro text.
Yes.
So I discovered this problem by looking at Full Story, that people were clicking on the intro text for some reason. We didn't know why, did we?
Nope.
So I mentioned this on the show when I was talking about Full Story and how great it is for being able to see what people are clicking on and what people are doing and that kind of stuff. And somebody came back in the Slack channel and said, I wonder whether people are selecting it so that they can share it on social media. Aha, I thought. And it didn't look like they were sharing it, because you can actually, sorry, that they were selecting it, because you can obviously see that on Full Story.
Yeah.
And so, but I thought, well, it's a hypothesis, let's give it a go. So I added this kind of medium type functionality that when you select text now on my website, you get this little pop-up that allows you to share the text on Twitter, Facebook or whatever. So I've left that running for a little while, and I've now looked at the results of that, right? So there's been 143 people have clicked on the copy in the headline in the last week. And of those, 4 then used the sharing facility.
Because people probably just want to just grab it like they normally would with text. They don't want to use some fancy tool.
No, see, now I dug into it a little bit further and narrowed down my search results, and I think I've got to the bottom of it. It's people that are on mobile devices. So it's where they click to start scrolling or tap to start scrolling. So after all that, it turned out to be nothing.
So it's just literally the point where people put their finger to scroll down the page.
Yes.
Well, at least you know.
I know, but you do think, so what that says, Full Story just wasted a load of my time. That's not how you're supposed to promote. But it did reveal the answer to the problem. And to be honest, you wouldn't have even, you know, just that whole journey I found really interesting in terms of using Full Story. You know, I could spot something in the analytics. I could go in, watch videos of people actually doing it. I could then look at a kind of heat maps to see if lots of people were doing it. I could form a hypothesis. I could test the hypothesis, find out I was wrong, go back to the drawing board. all within Full Story. So it's a really good way of diagnosing problems and improving your site. So you could try it yourself, because it's absolutely free to give it a go. In fact, you can use it free forever if you want to. It will record 1,000 sessions per month, absolutely free. But you can record more sessions than that for a month for free to really see what it does when it digs into absolutely everything on your site. And you can get that month for free by going to fullstory.com/BOAG. So, yeah, that's Full Story. Okay, let's move on to our first speaker, who is Matthew. Matthew is a product designer. He introduces himself properly as part of this talk in Brooklyn. And he works primarily on large enterprise mobile and desktop appy type things. You can find out more about him at Matthew. I'm going to spell this. So it's M-A-T-T-E-W. Know how to spell Matthew, and then his surname is VOSHELL, and then that's .com. So check out his talk, because I think you'll really enjoy it. Very interesting indeed. He's writing a book at the moment, and I'm really excited to see it, because it looks like a really good one. Anyway, this is Matthew's talk.
Hi. My name is Matthew Voschel, and I'm a product designer in New York City. Today, my lightning talk will be based on an article I recently wrote called Product Design Playbook, Concepts and Methodologies to Live By. Now, I'm only going to cover a few parts today, so feel free to go to my Medium page, medium.com/@mvoschel, to read the whole article. So let's get started. Now, being a product designer is a complex orchestration of processes and exploration. You often wear many hats, juggling a diverse skill set of research, analysis, information architecture, visual design, and interaction design. I often see articles that claim to tell you what steps you need to take to be a successful designer, but I feel that they leave out an important aspect. What does it really take to effectively and efficiently deploy modern, agile, user experience design processes on a day-to-day basis? So to me, our main challenge is really knowing which design methodology to use and when. So that we're all on the same page, let's take a step back for a second and try to understand what product design really is. To me, product design is a human-centered approach to designing products that draw inspiration from the needs of users, the possibilities of technology, and the requirements for business success. So what does that really mean? It means that instead of focusing on getting the user to conform to the way a system works, product design aims to form the system to operate in the way the user works. Technology is often very easy to manipulate. It just takes a little bit of effort, but trying to manipulate a user's behavior is incredibly hard to do. Now, I mentioned the facets of product design at the beginning of this, but let's spend a minute understanding what I believe are the five main facets of product design. It's user research, which allows you to understand user behaviors, needs, and motivations. There's interaction design, in which you create products that enable the user to achieve their objective or objectives in a best possible way. There's business strategy, which involves understanding the overall vision and identifying the business values behind every decision. There's visual design, where you strategically implement images, colors, fonts, and other elements. And content strategy, which involves planning, writing, delivery, and governance of all the content. Now, currently I have 12 plays. These are methodologies and concepts I believe you should understand if you really want to get past that imposter syndrome and finally be comfortable calling yourself a product designer. These are also great reference points to give to workmates or managers that just want to learn more about what you're doing, but you're really tired of repeating over and over again. Just send them my Medium article and pray that they read it. Let's start with a major play to call, design thinking. Now, this is a very hot topic being taught all over enterprises and college campuses today. To me, design thinking just means tackling complex problems in a non-linear way by building empathy with users, prototyping, and more importantly, or most importantly, tolerance for failure. Now, there are five stages to design thinking. There's empathize, define, ideate, prototype, and test. Now, in the beginning, there's empathy. To me, empathy is about truly understanding the problem you're trying to solve. It sounds like a really simple concept, but many companies who are very efficient at solving problems often do so without really taking the time to understand if they're solving the right problem in the first place. So take the time to really understand the problem that needs to be solved. This means performing user interviews, root cause analysis, asking the five whys, taking the user out for coffee, whatever you need to do to make sure that you're trying to understand and identify the right problem to solve. Next is define. Here's where you'll write the problem statement based on synthesized research analysis. I believe it's an important step to do before you rush to a solution. It's also good to share the research findings with your team or pod and to create a shared consensus and define the playing field in front of you. Following define is ideate, where you identify new solutions to the problem statement. This is pretty much the fun part. I consider this a yes and step, but the crazier the idea, the better. There is no such thing as thinking too big, only thinking too small. Focus on what the product should look like, assuming there were no limitations or any other issues that you might have to run into. You'll deal with refining feasibility, scope, and time after this. After ideation comes prototyping, where you investigate the generated solutions by simply experimenting just to see what works. Getting something in front of users is definitely better than nothing. It's important to understand that it takes courage for a designer to put something in that isn't perfect in front of someone, just to watch them tear it apart. But that's what it takes sometimes. Too often I've seen people over-design something, fighting over personal preferences, instead of just putting something in front of somebody and gaining user insight. Prototyping is an essential part of product design, as you may have seen from Google Ventures design sprints. I often use the analogy of buying a car. When you purchase a car, you sit in it, you take in the new car smell, you drive it around, you see how it handles, and so on. They don't show you the door and the wheel and say, yeah, these are the parts of it. Want to buy it now? So why should designers simply show a wireframe or two and expect the users to understand the vision? Finally comes testing. Here you'll rule out problem solutions through refinement and alterations. Part of the empathize phase, you should gain empathy and understanding for the user's environment. That includes device types and resolution sizes. Being thorough and testing on devices you expect the users to use will save you anguish and embarrassment, but also test on devices you think they wouldn't use. I still see designers that have portfolios that look great on desktops, but as soon as I open it on a mobile device, there are serious issues and errors, and if they had just tested it, they would have found these things. So I'm going to switch to another topic I'd like to cover, which is around ethnographic user research. It's the observation and analysis of human groups considered as individual entities in order to learn about users' goals and needs. Yet the bigger challenge is, despite the insights gained from field studies, few organizations take advantage of this technique. Even spending 2 weeks on user research will pay off in your solutions coming a lot closer to solving the problem instead of constantly redesigning and iterating your way to something that's kind of close. I have a few strategic points I always follow when conducting user research sessions. First and foremost, the user interview should be one-on-one. This creates an intimate environment where the interviewee can trust you. If you do it in a group session, the loudest person who tends to flap their gums will waste your time on things that probably won't matter, and you won't get to hear the important things the quiet person has to say. They tend to also not be as honest in a group setting as they may be in a private one-on-one session. So find a quiet, private office or space that you can use to conduct the interview. Next, make sure to ask open-ended questions. Doing this will help you avoid biasing or leading the interviewee to an answer you want to hear versus the one you should get. The question could be answered by a simple yes or no, change it. If the interviewee says an acronym or mentions something they think you should know, don't be afraid to ask the five whys. Listen for these moments and try to drill down to really understand the motivation behind the answer. Understanding motivations will help you design a better product when you understand why someone does a specific task instead of just what that task is. Each time you ask why, you get someone to reevaluate their position and dig a little deeper into their own reasoning. Another aspect of user interviews is improvisation. If you have the questions in a specific order, don't be afraid to change them around to fit the flow of the conversation. Often I'll ask a question and the interviewee will mention an answer to a question I plan on asking later. Just go with it, explore it, let the interview unfold naturally. And last, scribble. Especially if the interviewee is explaining a particular process or task, don't be afraid to draw on a paper or on a whiteboard to help them visualize the steps. This will also help you verify that what they describe is accurate and really get them to walk through the entire process. So that's it for now. I hope you found this talk informative. And again, for more, go to my page on Medium, medium.com/@mvochel to read more. Thanks a lot and good luck.
So there you go. That is Matthew. It's very much worth checking out the article that he mentioned. I went and had a look at it. I would say I'd read it, but I haven't.
Can I say the same?
Yeah, well, it's not surprising. It's massive. It is incredibly thorough and kind of goes into all kinds of details about product design. No wonder he only touched on a part of it in his talk. Now, this is what he's writing his book around. And it really is. It's an absolutely excellent article that I highly recommend you check out and give a read. But yeah, it was a good talk, wasn't it?
Yep. As I say, I've slightly bitten myself in the arse and not doing my usual notes when I look back and go, what does that mean? But the things I took away from that were his 3 points, three research-related points. I mean, obviously, we've gone on for years about the importance of user requirements and business objectives. But technology limitations was the third one, and I thought, do we just assume that? But I don't think about it as much as maybe I should. And the other one, obviously, is budget, because a small budget will change the way you approach research, or just the design of a product. in full. So I kind of thought there's, rather than just the two user requirements, business objectives things, there is also technology limitations and budget as well.
I think I can hear Ian and Chris crying. The thought that you just ignore technological constraints.
No, I don't ignore them. I just think we just assume them. We just go, yeah, that's it. That's the technology, or we obviously discuss technology. We're talking to a potential new client at the moment where it's kind of a bit of a toss-up between which technology we use. It was just the point of view of when you're considering designing a product, that there's an awful lot of stress on the first two, and maybe just a less, not enough thought goes into the technology limitations thing. That's all.
I think maybe that's your own mindset. Because if you were talking to Chris, you know, if you were talking to Chris or Ian, they would strongly disagree with that statement. Because in truth, they put a lot of thought into what it integrates with, and you know, and what payment gateways it's going to use, and all of that kind of stuff. But even in terms of, you know, what might come along in the future, whether it needs an API, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I see where you're coming from. You've got a point. I'll allow it.
Thanks, Paul.
That's all right. There was a lot in there I got out of it.
Yeah.
I thought it was really good. I mean, I really liked his idea of, it's a silly thing to say, but it's easier to manipulate technology into doing what you want than trying to manipulate users into working the way the technology wants. I liked that.
Very good.
So that was a nice one. The other one that I use all the time, although I'd never found it articulated it, he just made it as a very throwaway comment, but if you go into his article, it's got a bit more on it, which is, do you remember him mentioning the five whys?
Yes.
And I bet you thought, what does he mean, the five whys? What are the five whys, right?
I did.
The five
and
whys.
And I didn't look it up.
No, the five. Well, I did, because, you know, I actually give a shit about this show. The five whys are basically why, and why, right? So they're not like, I was thinking it would be why this, why that, why the other. But what it is to get to the root of a problem or a cause, you need to keep asking why.
Yeah, a minimum of five times.
A minimum of five times, yeah.
Very good.
Which I totally do all the time. I never knew it was a thing, but apparently it is. The five whys. I loved that. That really made me smile because I was expecting some really kind of complicated, why have you taken this design approach? Why are we adopting this technology? Why are we? But no, it's just why. Just keep asking why until you get to the problem.
In an annoying toddler kind of way.
Yeah, exactly. It should be the toddler technique.
Why?
Why?
I've got one of those at the moment. Couple of things. I mean, this thing about allowing failure, which I don't disagree with at all, but it's a lot easier said than done, especially if you're in an agency, you know, employed to do a job within a certain time. That's the end of my comment, really. It's just kind of like, yeah, I'm not sure how allowed to fail we are, for example. Maybe that's wrong. I think it's just the way it is.
Yeah, I don't think we necessarily are very good. People that talk about failure and failing fast, we're not very good at explaining what that actually means. I think what that's really referring to is this process of iteration.
Yeah.
Rather than necessarily failure, that you've got to accept that the first version you produce of something is not going to be the right version. And that when you test it, you know, you're going to get feedback about how to improve it and how to make it. It will have failed in some regards, and you'll need to tweak it and improve it and then test it again and then test it again and so on. It's that principle rather than, oh, you could just cock it up. That's okay. You know?
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that there is an implication, particularly with agile development, that you might fail. You might not finish what you're trying to do. and that's okay.
Yeah,
but I think if you've got a budget holder, it's not okay.
Yeah, I don't know whether if that is the implication, then I'm uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
You know, I think unless you're talking, well, it depends on what part of the process you're talking about, you know, because he would suggest you go through the process of discovery, alpha, beta, etc. If you're talking about a prototype failing, then fine. You know, a prototype can be disposable. You can build something very quickly and dirtily, go, no, that was entirely the wrong direction, let's scrap it. You know, so I guess it depends where you are in the project as to whether or not that's relevant.
Yeah, true. This isn't a black and white thing. It's just something that I just thought I'd comment on.
Yeah, because... and I do think there's a lot of vagueness around that as a concept. It would be easy to abuse because it's vague. I quite like the government digital services approach to it, which is... always be making new mistakes, and it's that word new. You know, you can't just be making another screwing up the same thing time and time again, you know.
We'll learn from your mistakes, I guess.
Yeah, is another way of putting it in there. That was really good. What was the other thing?
He had a couple of points. He talked about stakeholder interviews, he mentioned that they should be one-on-one, which I do agree with, but not always. We've found that if you're interviewing somebody who is uncomfortable with it being one-on-one, then you're better off getting a group. Is a perfect example of that. Young students.
Yeah.
We found we get more from a kind of group of two or three than we do on one-on-ones.
That's interesting. Yeah, I can imagine that, actually.
Yeah, and the other point was, which I agree with entirely, is this idea of you need to be able to improvise. You need to let the interview... Of course, you're going to have a script and there's things you want to ask them and you want to get a response to, but you just got to go with it. You've got to go with where they want to go and be prepared to kind of, you know, ask new questions relating to what they're telling you. So, yeah.
The one I liked, you talked about... spending some time working free from constraints, and he was talking about, you know, just exploring lots of different ideas without worrying too much about the constraints. And I think that's so important, because so often I see, especially in-house teams, self-censoring themselves. Oh, we can't do that because we'll never get it past so-and-so, or no, we can't do that because of the technological constraints, or compliance won't like that, or do you see what I mean? And so the result is you don't do anything. You end up compromising before you need to.
Yeah.
So that I thought was really good. And the other thing that he said, he mentioned field studies and going out and seeing people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do that very often, but when I've done it, it's just been the best thing ever. Were you with me the day we did it with Wiltshire Farm Foods?
I was not.
Oh, that was so good. It was it's just a brilliant thing to do. You get to know the user in a way that you just do not do in any other situation. If you sit and do an interview with them, if you do usability testing, nothing is as good as going into their home or their place of work and sitting with them in that kind of environment. It's just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Even if you only do it for a day, it's worth doing. You know, just to try it. And not even on every project. Just try it out once. You'll get hooked, I promise.
Wasn't that the testing when you were asking somebody to click on something and they couldn't see it because they had a post-it note over the corner of their screen?
Yeah, that was the one.
Classic.
That was great. I mean, you know, you'd never get that in testing in a usability lab. No, okay, you can't design for that. But, you know, it What was really interesting going into that woman's home was that you realised how cluttered and distracted her user experience is. You know, she had cats and she had knickknacks and, you know, she had things on the screen and, you know, so her experience was a very distracted experience, and that you can design for. So, yeah, it was good. It was really good. Okay, so that was Matthew's talk. Again, check out the article. We'll put a link in the show notes for that one. Now, let's talk about FreshBooks. FreshBooks are our second sponsor. So it's a super intuitive tool to make sending and creating invoices really, really simple. So using FreshBooks, you can really, it only takes about 30 seconds really to create an invoice and send it. You can obviously customize the invoices in any way you want with your logos and color and all the rest of it. Your clients can pay online, which is really useful because you get paid a lot quicker that way. They'll also provide you with loads of information about whether or not your clients have looked at the invoice, whether they've paid the invoice, whether they've looked at your email, all of that kind of stuff. And it can deal with late reminders of emails going out. If there needs to be a reminder sent out, it will send it out automatically. But it'll also do more than that. It'll also help you track your expenses. So no more boxes full of receipts, which makes life really easy. And it's got a great mobile app as well, so you can even take pictures of your receipts and just save them and create expense reports and all of that kind of stuff. Just really, really straightforward. FreshBooks is offering a month of unrestricted use to anybody who's listening to this. You can just go and get it totally free for right now, and you don't need to enter a credit card in order to do that. So to claim your free month of unrestricted access, just go to freshbooks.com/boagworld. But when you fill it in, there'll be a how did you hear about us box. If you could put into that the Boag World show or the Boag World UX show or something like that, that would be very much appreciated, because it just lets them know that sponsoring the show works.
Their investment was worthwhile.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. They might do it again then. Yeah. That'd be lovely. Woo. All right. So next up, we've got 6 layers of design. Sounds like a cake.
Cake.
This is Ross Johnson, who we know from right back in the day. Okay. So he used to present one of the very first web design podcasts called Web Axe. So when there weren't many of us around, he was one of them, which was a web accessibility podcast. So it's lovely to hear from him again. And he's kind of kept in touch on and off ever since. So he now runs a design studio called 3.7 Designs.
Okay.
I'm trying to work out where that name comes from. And he's very much like Headscape, I think, works with all kinds of different organizations on design and, transformative stuff and that kind of thing. He also teaches at Michigan State University. So does all kinds of interesting things. So anyway, he's going to talk about this idea of 6 layers of design. So over to Ross.
I decided to become a web designer in high school. It was the late 1990s, and all the gaming websites had these really cool, seasonally appropriate banners, all crafted by the same designer, Walter Kosniak. I was hooked. I wanted to be Walter. The thought that I could create some cool graphic that people from around the world would see and appreciate just really excited me. So for the next 3 or 4 years, I freelanced with one goal in mind: make websites that look awesome. I was pretty successful, I think. I spent hours scouring the internet for Photoshop tutorials, learning new techniques of how to create interesting new things, and look for any opportunity to use that technique in a website, not really thinking about whether it was appropriate or not. Now, by the mid-2000s, I was a little wiser, a little more educated. I learned that design is not just about aesthetic appeal. Design is a form of communication. And to me, at least at the time, that meant don't just make it look awesome, make it look the right kind of awesome. The awesome had to align with the brand tone. Not too long later, I heard the all too famous Steve Jobs design quote, and it shook my perspective on design. If you haven't heard it, it goes something like this: design is not just how it looks and feels like, design is how it works. I'd stumbled across usability, and it became one of my primary concerns. I kind of went over the top. I became a walking soapbox, touting and preaching the importance of search, sitemaps, sticking to convention and simplicity. I would shame people for trying to make things complex or clever when they should use something easy to understand instead. Shortly thereafter, I learned a whole host of new things: key performance indicators, conversions, calls to action. It turns out, design isn't just about looking awesome. It's not communication. It's not just usability. Design needs to serve a purpose. These things are being created for a reason, and they should try and fulfill that reason. So it's about this point I got to thinking, are these the only criteria for successful design? If a website serves a purpose, is usable, and communicates the right things, is it destined for success? Or was I still missing out on different things, things I didn't know about? Let's consider these examples of design. Have you ever wanted to have a picnic but didn't have a blanket? Or maybe you wanted to have a picnic but didn't want to carry a blanket. Well, you might want the picnic pants. These are pants that have this special flap in the front that creates an eating surface in your lap anytime you sit down. So you don't have to worry about carrying a blanket or even finding a table. You can just sit down and put your sandwich on your lap. They make it easy to have a picnic. They're easy to use. You just sit down. They look stylish, at least for the time. But for some reason, they weren't successful. Or maybe you find yourself panicked during the day because you're not sure how many fresh eggs you have at home. You should buy a smart egg carton. This internet-connected egg carton is sleek, it's easy to use, and has an app that informs you how many eggs you have left and whether they're spoiled or not. Sound useful? So neither of these two products were successful, even though they seemed to meet the criteria that I had come across earlier in my career. So yeah, maybe there's more to it than just, does it serve a purpose, is it easy to use, and is it aesthetically pleasing? It was time to do some more research. As I scoured the internet looking for different information and articles and research on successful design, I came across a concept called the design hierarchy of needs. So this concept is modeled off of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is a framework of human needs that need to be met in order for someone to become a high achiever. So it starts with these very basic needs like water, food, shelter, and then moves into more advanced needs like love and sense of purpose. And the higher up you move in these needs, in theory, more high achieving you become. So the design hierarchy of needs is very similar in concept. There's these low-level needs that need to be met, and as those are met, you can address the higher-level needs, and the design becomes more and more successful as you address said needs. This concept really shifted the way that I thought about design. Not only did it cover three needs I'd previously identified, it had two more. So starting from the most important, it detailed that high-performing design needed to have the following. It needed to be functional. Could it actually accomplish what it was supposed to accomplish? Was it reliable? Was it designed in such a way that it was stable and consistent in its performance? Was it usable? Okay, I got in this one, but yeah, is it easy to understand and forgiving? Was it proficient? Did it actually make the user better at doing something? Then finally, creativity. Did it have aesthetic beauty? Well, this is a good start. The more that I thought about it, I soon realized that maybe creativity was too broad a category and needed to become two more specific categories, communication and emotion. And finally, proficiency felt a little bit too focused on industrial design, and I realized valuable was a better way to describe it. So the result is a way to approach and think about design that I call the six layers of design. Rather than a pyramid like Maslow's hierarchy of needs or the original design hierarchy of needs, I think of these as layers, kind of like a cake, that build on top of each other. It's not necessarily that the top layer is the smallest, most pointiest. It's just that they build on top of each other in kind of a more equal way. So the most successful designs address all six layers, starting by focusing at the bottom of the hierarchy and moving up. As this applies to the web, I take the following away from each layer. The first layer is functionality. And when I say functionality, I don't mean what sort of features are being developed. Rather, what is the actual function or intended function of the site? What are you trying to get out of it? So this really boils down to, have you agreed upon and established what are the objectives of the site? What are you trying to get out of it? While this seems very simple, there's a lot of projects that I've seen where these sort of things haven't really been concretely established. You know, people will say like, well, you know, we have to have a web presence these days or our website's looking shabby and we want it to, you know, reflect us better. They haven't gone so far as to really drill down and understand what it is that means. Are you trying to get more sales? Are you trying to generate leads? Are you trying to reduce overhead? Maybe you get a lot of customer support issues that could be better addressed online. So really, these things need to be established so that throughout the entire design process, you can reflect back and see, are we building and designing this in such a way that it meets and will accomplish its intended function? Now, once the site function has been determined, you really need to think about reliability. Now, while this doesn't sound super sexy, it's actually really important in the context of the web. If you think about it, people access websites in a variety of different situations, contexts, technologies, etc. And it's important that the site reliably performing across all those different situations. So what happens when somebody, you know, visits the site, say, by a mobile device or a tablet? Or what if they're using some sort of assistive technology like a screen reader? Or maybe they're in some place where they have a slow internet connection. You know, not everybody has access to 4G, even today. Does the site still function as intended? So it's really important that whatever you're doing doesn't impact the reliability of the site. Now, it's not just about responsive design and accessibility. You might design something that, you know, maybe has a dependency on a JavaScript library like jQuery, and that's a fail point. And if that's not absolutely necessary, well, you're unnecessarily reducing the potential success of the site. Even if you're just doing kind of more the design and less the building, you really should think about what implications your design decisions might have before you add that huge hero image that might take a really long time to download on a slow internet connection. The next layer is usability. Now, I won't belabor the point because I think we're all to a place where we can agree that usability is really important. Now, I will say that a lot of people will agree that usability is really important, but there's still a lot of situations where websites end up with usability problems. And it's not because anybody necessarily thought like, well, this doesn't need to be usable. Rather, it doesn't get the focus that it needs or maybe the attention that it needs. Is the site designed using the mental model of the audience rather than the mental model of the organization? So if you're not familiar with mental model, it's kind of the way in which somebody perceives the world, and we all perceive the world slightly differently. So these first three layers are what I would call deficiency needs. So if these things don't exist, then the site is deficient to the point where it really has a hard time being successful. If it can't fulfill its desired function, maybe it doesn't have the necessary functionality, like, let's say, a contact form when you're trying to generate leads, or it doesn't perform reliably, where most people, when they access the site, have trouble actually getting it to function in the way that it should, or it's so difficult to use, people leave before they spend the time and energy to figure it out, well, it's going to be really, really hard for that to be successful. But once these things are addressed, you can move on to the more value-add needs, where it kind of they build on each other and take the site from a place where it can be successful and accelerate it and make it even more successful. And the first layer after the deficiency layers is value. Does the site actually generate value for users? Now, people don't visit your site for no reason. They expect to get something out of trading their valuable time. And that's really what the value layer is all about. Because ultimately, you can have a website that's intuitive and easy to understand that doesn't offer the user what they're looking for. So if your site doesn't consider what the user wants and what the user is trying to get out of their efforts, then it's not going to be very successful, even if it is usable. I like to think of this in terms of industrial design. So if you consider a wooden park bench, it's perfectly usable as a sitting surface. It's usually reliable, and it serves its function. But in terms of having a comfortable place to sit and rest for a long time, well, it's not all that valuable, especially if you consider an alternative like a ergonomically designed office chair by Herman Miller. So it's not enough to think about what do you want to get out of the site or what do your clients want to get out of the site. You need to really understand and think about your users and understand their situation. What are they trying to accomplish? And what can you do to make them more successful at it? Because the more successful you make them, the more likely they are to do whatever it is that you want them to do, be it become a customer, a lead, donate to your cause, or become a brand advocate, etc. Next, we have communication, which this is kind of more of the visual layer of the site. So our brains are wired to quickly try and make sense of complex environments or situations around us as a way of assessing, is this situation safe or dangerous? And this even happens on the web. So way back, there used to be danger at every curve, and we had to quickly try and figure out, you know, as soon as you go into a new area, am I likely to be eaten by a tiger, or is this a place where I can be safe and maybe find some food? Now, how this applies to the web is that when people first see your site, they're going to make dozens, if maybe not 100, of near-instant assumptions as a way of trying to figure out what is this website all about. And if the tone doesn't communicate the right message, people are going to get the wrong impression. The colors, the images, the typography, the white space, the layout, they all tell the user something. And it's important that they tell the user the right things. Otherwise, they'll get the wrong idea, they'll get confused, and they're much less likely to convert into a lead, a customer, etc. So ultimately, you can have an aesthetically pleasing site that's completely off message. A luxury brand, for example, with an aesthetically pleasing but maybe rustic look and feel, could confuse users once they saw prices or maybe what the actual products looked like that didn't align with the design of the site. Also, a friendly family lawyer could have a cold corporate look and feel, maybe they picked out a generic lawyer template, when in reality, a warm, inviting design better aligned with the type of lawyer they are and the customers that they were. Finally, we have the emotion layer. In my opinion, emotion is an under-discussed aspect of design. A portion of the emotional response to a site is, how beautiful is it? Does it create a feeling that, you know, this is something that we're attracted to, which is not a logical feeling, it's more of an emotion. To get in more detail, if you do some research into human psychology, you'll quickly find that many of our decisions are actually heavily influenced by our subconscious. Now, we might ultimately justify those decisions with logic, but the truth is that original kernel that caused us to make that final decision happened without us even really thinking about it. See, our brains are made up of three different systems, the reptilian, the limbic, and the neocortex. The reptilian is the oldest and fastest acting part of our brain. It's responsible for automatic responses such as breathing, heart rate, body temperature, and balance. The limbic system, also a very fast-acting portion of our brain, controls emotions. And then finally, the neocortex, which is the youngest portion of our brain and the slowest, is conscious thought. Now, the reptilian and the limbic system are the fastest-acting portions of our brain because conscious thought is slow. And when faced with potential danger, maybe a car rushing at you at 60 miles an hour or 60 kilometers an hour, depending on where you are in the world, you don't have time to think about, ooh, how do I get out of the way? You just have to act. If you took the time to try and assess all the different situations, you'd get hit by the car and, well, that would be unfortunate. So, how does this relate to web design? Well, think back to the last time you made a really big decision. Maybe it was buying a house, taking a new job, ultimately deciding who to date or maybe marry. Well, while you probably rated the pros and cons, what ultimately swayed your decision was which option felt right. And this feeling right was a subconscious influence based on emotion. Now, there's this very famous and interesting study where they took a whole bunch of subjects that had a very specific kind of brain damage. And the only effect that brain damage had was they had no ability to feel emotion. Other than that, they could think and behave perfectly fine. Now, what they found is that those people had the hardest time or couldn't really make even simple decisions like, what do you want for breakfast? Because while you might logically try and think, do I want cereal or do I want bananas? Ultimately, you make that decision based on what feels right. So if we make decisions based on emotion and our website exists to serve a purpose that's accomplished when a user completes an action such as sign up for a newsletter, purchase a product, etc., well, then we need to trigger an emotional response in order to be successful. Now, there are three types of emotional responses. Visceral, which occurs in our central nervous system. This is fight or flight. Behavioral, this is emotions felt from actually doing or using something. Think about playing a sport and feeling like you did really good. And then reflective, which is conscious thought. A good example would be nostalgia. Now, while I don't have enough time to go through each and every one, you can do some research to learn more about each approach and how you might use it in your design. So those are the six layers of design. And if you're like me, you might intuitively understand the needs of all six layers, but maybe don't intentionally consider each concept when you're actually designing. And what this framework has helped me do is be more strategic throughout the design process. It's also helped me have an easier time convincing my clients of my recommendations. So what I do is when I'm completing a design, I'll actually write out how my concept addresses each need to ensure I've arrived at the strongest possible concept. Then I can review those things with my clients, and they get a really strong idea of my thought process and see where maybe I've intentionally made some compromises. I've chosen maybe a less big and impactful hero image because I'm thinking about the reliability of the site, or I'm thinking about the usability, or maybe I prioritized a user task over a conversion point because I'm considering what's the value to the user. So I hope this is helpful, and in the future, when you're thinking about design, you're thinking about all six layers that need to be addressed for the strongest possible concepts.
Okay, so that was good. I liked him very much. I have to say I associated with him quite heavily when he was talking about that whole thing of becoming a little bit fanatical and evangelical about things and maybe kind of shaming people. I've never done that.
No, ever. Not ever. I love the start of that talk. The kind of like, this is what captured me, and then I learnt a bit more, and like I say, I got evangelical about that, and then I realised that it was wrong. It was great.
It's very honest, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Which is great.
I loved the bit about cool graphics at the start, because mm-hmm. I was exactly the same. I wasn't producing them, but that's what hooked me into what, you know, all the design work that you and Lee and all the guys at Town Pages did was kind of very graphic heavy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I was just wowed by that from the start. And to a certain extent, I still am. Mm. I still love kind of things that...
Make you go ooh.
Well, yeah. I mean, or to use the cliche, things that pop.
Oh no!
I know that's what, when a client says that, that's what they mean, though, isn't it? They mean something that just has a bit of a wow about it, and design that I still get wowed by wowy design.
You ought to check out the new upcoming the beta of the Smashing Magazine website.
Okay.
I'm just trying to remember what the URL is, because it's got some beautiful little kind of details in it, you know, of animations, really subtle little animations when you roll over stuff, and
nice.
It's just, you know, that kind of stuff is gorgeous, isn't it?
To go on to a little bit of a tangent here, we are currently umming and ahhing about whether we want to pitch for a piece of work that we've been invited to pitch for, and it's for a famous chef.
Ah.
But basically, if you ask questions along the lines of, so who are the audiences for the website and all this kind of thing, it's basically him. And you're like, really? And it's, yes, because in his hotel, he has designed every aspect of every room, down to, you know, how the light shines in from the windows and the you know, the different fabrics and et cetera, all that kind of thing. And he wants to have the same kind of control over his website. And he would basically be the lead designer. And it's just like, it could be amazing, could be a nightmare. So we're just having this kind of like, don't know what to do, don't know whether to respond or not. Because, I mean, the pitch would have to be a kind of full-on ad agency-style pitch of many, many ideas, lots of upfront work. Yeah. Otherwise, you're not going to win it. But it could be a relationship that lasted 10 years.
I don't think it's headscope, personally.
I don't either, but...
I think it's an interesting point. Yeah, you'd lose it to some, like you say, some ad agency that knows how to pitch like that and knows how to operate like that. But, I mean, you know, whatever.
Just an interesting point, anyway.
It is.
That there is still a requirement somewhere out there for kind of...
egotistical...
fancy, over-the-top design, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there are people that, yes, there are a lot of people that do that kind of work. It's just, it's my fault, Marcus. I'm the one that took us away from the popping direction into the boring ass world of UX and accessibility and all that kind of crap. Yawn.
Not at all, because I was talking about that, just relating to that particular pitch. You know, Ed in particular is a very minimalist designer.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't suit him at all. So.
No. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, in actual fact, they're not mutually exclusive. You know, that's what Ross was talking about. He said, dragging it back to the subject at hand. You know,
sorry, Ross.
One layer of design builds upon another. And yeah, so, you know, yes, it does need to be usable, et cetera, but... you know, you do want it to pop a bit. You do want it to excite and, you know, persuade and, you know, all of the rest of it. So, you know, it's not at all mutually exclusive. I mean, this is where Mr. Clark would get very opinionated on that, you know, I think, you know, he would say, and I agree with him, that we often stop at too low a level. It's interesting because I did exactly the same thing as Ross with... the idea of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you know, he talked about the design hierarchy, and I've created a site hierarchy. So at the bottom, you start with where your site has to be accessible, you know, to people with disabilities, with different devices, using different bandwidth, etc. Then it has to be relevant. Does it actually tell the user what they want to know? You know, because if it doesn't actually answer their questions, then what's the point? Then it has to be usable. Can the user actually find the information that they need on the website? Then it has to be personal. Does the website cater for individuals' specific needs, or is it very generic? And then finally, you know, is it persuasive? You know, and that's when you get into the, does it excite you? Does it, you know, engage with you emotionally, etc.? So yeah, it's a very good way of thinking, you know, about how these things build on top of one another.
Yeah, I think I mentioned some time ago on this show about Dieter Rams' 10 Principles of Good Design. Something that Ed put me onto. I'll read them out. I won't go into the long descriptions, but good design is innovative. Good design makes a product useful. Good design is aesthetic. Good design makes a product understandable. Good design is unobtrusive. Good design is honest. Good design is long-lasting. Good design is thorough down to the last detail. Good design is environmentally friendly. Good design is as little design as possible. And there's a lot more detail on that. But yeah, Dieter Rams, 10 Principles of Good Design.
Yeah, definitely worth checking out. I got to say, I find these kinds of things really quite useful, these touch points that just kind of bring you back and say, okay, am I doing the basics? Am I covering everything that I need to cover? Like a checklist almost to look at your design. And that's one thing I loved. I loved his idea of reflecting back that hierarchy to clients as a way of justifying your design approach. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah. Well, even more fundamentally, he said design is creating something for a reason. And it's like, well, that's the fundamental, isn't it? You might be asked to do a job where, you know, there's no point to it.
Yeah.
So that resonated.
Yeah, and the trouble is, I think people often like to jump to the higher levels of these, you know, the pop bit, without getting the underlying stuff right, and that's where your problems start coming in. But it was a great talk, absolutely brilliant.
Very good.
Right, so you've ruined my wrap up because we've already talked about what's going to be in next season. So you know,
you can say it again, Paul, if you want.
No, not really. I don't care. You just ruined the show. Because that was going to be my big kind of cliffhanger at the end.
It's not really a big cliffhanger, though, is it?
No, not at all. So we'll have to use your joke instead. This has got to be the big ending to, you know.
Okay. Well, it's a Bruce Lawson joke. Well, it's not a Bruce. I've seen it before, but I noticed it on Twitter, on his Twitter feed.
Oh, yeah, I saw this. Yeah.
To quickly tell the sex of an ant, put it in water and see if it sinks. Sinks? Girl ant. Floats, boy ant.
Oh, no. That wasn't the joke that I saw. I saw a different one. Boy ant.
Boy ant.
That is just...
Wonderful is what it is.
I wonder whether we could persuade Bruce next season just to do a joke, a show, just to record a whole load of them. Oh, no, I'm taking your thing, aren't I?
I feel hurt.
Sorry, Marcus. I love you, really.
Maybe we could get him to do a few.
I don't want to take it away from you, Marcus. Yeah. I didn't even think. I was insensitive.
No, exactly. You didn't think, Paul.
No. My wife tells me that all the time. Right. So there we go. That is this week's show. Join us again next week. We're getting there now. We've got, what, only 3 more shows to do this season. And I think next week we might have 3 talks. So we really will have to cut the waffle down because we've run over this week and my wife will be cross as she transcribes the show.
And we keep on talking now. What's that now?
Should we just... We could use really long, complicated words just to annoy her. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. I am in so much trouble.
What's the longest word in the English language?
Flocky, knocky, near perfilification.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. That is a real word.
Disestablishmentarianism.
No. Flocky, knocky, near perfilification. It was on Countdown. What?
Okay. Seriously. I'm going to have to go and look that up.
How the hell are you going to spell it? It's a medical word.
Right.
So there we go.
All right. Yeah. Whatever.
So let me get this straight. We said so far, flocky knocky neoperfilification, disestablishmentarianism,
mm-hmm.
and supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. And now I've just said all three of those all over again.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you need to bullet it out and do it one at a time? So one.
One, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. You can do two.
Two was disestablishmentarianism.
And three was flocky knocky neoperfilification.
I might have faded out by this point, Paul.
I love you, Kath. you're a wonderful human being. Okay. I think we'll fade out the end because this is just really terrible. Oh, no. All right. So, thank you for listening to the show. And goodbye. Bye.